Welcome to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast, where we interview our industry's top female executives from Australia, New Zealand, and around the world. I'm Michelle Batsis, your host and the Chief Executive Officer of the Public Transport Association, Australia, New Zealand. We're raising the voices of women for everyone who works in public transport and mobility, and particularly for any of our listeners who are early in their transport careers and looking for inspiration. Each of our guests shares her views on the future of public transport and provides insights into their career journeys. Make sure you follow Women Who Move Nations on your favorite podcast platform and rate the show to help more people find us. You can also join our community on LinkedIn by searching Public Transport Association Australia New Zealand. We're also on Twitter at PTAANZ_, or visit us at www.ptaanz.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Now it's time to introduce today's guest. Laura Schoaf is the Chief Executive of the West Midlands Combined Authority, and she's joining us all the way from Birmingham in England. Laura, thank you so much for being here and welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. Let's get stuck into some of the questions. I'm really keen to hear a bit more about your current role. You were appointed as the Chief Executive of the West Midlands Combined Authority in 2021. Could you share with our listeners, what does your role involve and what are your key priorities at the moment?
Sure. So we are a partnership organization, which includes our seven authorities here in the West Midlands, some big cities, Birmingham, which is the second largest city in the UK, Wolverhampton and Coventry, as well as four other borough councils. But we also work together where we know that the things that we do as at regional scale make a bigger impact. So, for example, we develop the economic strategy for the region. We invest the adult education skills budget, so invest in training and skills programs to help both our citizens and our businesses. We invest in culture, in housing. As I mentioned, we operate the transport system, including owning and operating our metro scheme. And then we also do a lot around net zero development, housing retrofit, smart local energy systems, the low carbon and circular economy, and how that works with building new houses. And then we have a lot of work that we do around the region. For example, we'll come on to it later, I'm sure, supporting the delivery of the Commonwealth Games and digital connectivity and promoting our region to our own government and governments around the world. So it's quite an exciting job and a real pleasure to get to work on behalf of a really big region in the UK, doing those things that we can do at scale.
Wow, there's so many exciting things that you're working on, and some of those topics so familiar to what we're talking about here, net zero, circular economy, and also Commonwealth Games. So I'm not sure if you're aware, but very recently, Melbourne in Australia has been awarded the Commonwealth Games in 2026. So I'm sure you've got lots of learnings actually for us to hear about as well.
Oh, do we?
Well, we'll have to have a whole nother session just to talk about that. I wanted to ask you, so before you became Chief Executive of the West Midlands Combined Authority, you were the Managing Director of Transport for West Midlands. And I would love to understand a bit more about this role. And I think what's really interesting is to understand what that transition has been like for you, given that you had a sole focus on transport and now you've moved into a role where you have a broader range of accountabilities and scope. And I think what's particularly interesting in this is because I think often as women, we could find ourselves in a new opportunity where you have broad range of accountabilities and particularly for areas that you might not be so familiar with. So I wanted to ask you, this question's in two parts, but the first one I wanted to ask you was, how has that transition been for you going from Chief Executive of Transport for West Midlands to West Midlands Combined Authority? And how did you prepare for it?
So it was intimidating, for sure. So I went from a job, Transport for West Midlands is a part of the Combined Authority. So I had been responsible for running a very big part of this Combined Authority before I took the new job on. but it was intimidating for sure. I knew what I was doing in transport. I've been working in transport in this country and in my native United States for 2 decades. I had the contacts that I needed. I knew how things work, and I had a lot of confidence in my ability to deliver. And making a transition into a bigger job where, yes, of course, transport is still a key part of what I do day to day, but needing to learn about whole new aspects of what this organization does and then to lead them was challenging. And how did I prepare for it? Really as best I could. I mean, I think you have to recognize that you are not going to be an expert in everything on the day that you start. And being aware of that and being honest about that and making sure that you listen to the people that are experts, that you ask questions. You know, one of my favorite questions is, I don't know, what do you think? Because, there are just situations that I don't know the answers, but I know the people who do. And so I think at some level, you prepare as best you can and you realize that part of your job is to lead. And you don't have to be an expert in every element of what you do in order to lead people well and allow them to do their jobs as the experts.
Great advice. That's going to stick with me. I don't know. What do you think? I'm going to actually put a post-it of that on my computer. I think that's a really good reminder, actually, just around, you know, your own knowledge, but also giving the opportunity for others. I wanted to ask you, you know, specifically, have you got any advice for women who are moving into new roles where they've got a broader span of responsibilities and have to do things they haven't done before?
Just to recognize really that it's tough and that nobody expects you to know everything on the first day. The other thing I would say is there are lots of people that give you advice. You know, you have to have a 60-day plan, a 90-day plan, a 6-month plan. But actually what's really important is that you take that job and you make it your own. And you shape it. You don't have to march to somebody else's drum in order to be successful in that job. People have their own natural way of being leaders, and you need to sort of trust your authentic self, which is really difficult. I remember when I took the job in transport, I decided that I wanted to sit out on the floor and not in an office. And the person who'd done the job before me had an office, and everyone said, oh, well, you know, he never would have done that. And I thought, oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't then. And I got very tangled up in what other people thought I should or shouldn't do, or what the person before me did or didn't do in the job. And it didn't do me any favors. Actually, the best thing to do is to realize that you will lead the way that you lead, and you need to be true to that bit of yourself and be authentic, because people know when you're not being authentic. And I think that's a worse place to be, and be able to admit when you get things right and admit when you get things wrong. And I think if you start a new job with that sort of belief in yourself, but not necessarily cockiness, that sort of humble nature that you realize you don't know everything and you will be learning, but you're not afraid to admit when you get it wrong and put it right, I think that's the best way to start out in something. And also then just to realize that everybody who takes a new job, no matter who they are, has aspects of that job they are not an expert in. And learning on the job is okay. You don't need to be an expert on day one.
That is awesome advice. Thank you for sharing, Laura. So much there for everyone to take away. But I just want to say, I really appreciate you sharing so openly and honestly, you know, your thoughts and experience with that as well. I wanted to ask you a bit more about transport specifically now. And I guess, reflecting on your current role and also previously as MD for Transport for West Midlands, I know you've done some really impressive work. And I read that you secured a transport investment package worth £4 billion for the region, and you managed an annual operating budget of £1.5 million. I'm assuming it's more now, but that budget was for road, rail, bus and tram systems. And, you know, here in Australia and New Zealand, there's a lot of investment going into transport. So could you share with us, what were your key lessons as a leader overseeing a lot of change on your public transport network while trying to keep day-to-day services running with minimal disruption?
I think it's important to remember who relies on the network. So I know that I now, sort of in a post-COVID world, have a slightly different perspective on this, but I think the most important thing to me is ensuring the reliability of the network for the people who depend on it the most. So when you're building new extensions, new stations, when you're expanding a network and trying to improve public service provision where you are, it has to be balanced with the needs of the people who rely on that network. You know, in our region, we have, I think it's 30% of the people in this region don't have access to a vehicle. They entirely rely on public transport to get to, whether that's their educational opportunities or their jobs or to see family or to socialize or to shop. So I think for me, it's very easy to shut your network down completely, build what you need to build, and then reopen it. But that doesn't work. So to me, the thing I think I learned the most about and the biggest challenge was, how do you keep a provision going for the people who depend on it while expanding the network? And I think that is one of the most challenging things about trying to bring cities that need an amazing public transport network, because that's the mark of an amazing place, isn't it? Really, I think, is, you know, places that have that ability to travel around them without having to depend on a car. So I think that's been the biggest challenge for all. There's no doubt that when you build any sort of transport infrastructure, you cause disruption, whether that's to businesses or to people who live near to it. So it's a highly disruptive thing that you do, but doing it in the most patient way, in the way that respects the people who rely on it, who live near to it, because when it's done, everyone is always really delighted to have it.
That was an awesome reflection, actually. You really got me thinking, particularly, this is my new tagline, I think, ensuring the reliability of the network for the people who rely on it the most. I mean, that really is at the core of what we do in transport. And I think we've just got to make sure that's top of mind always. Thank you for sharing that, Laura. I wanted to ask you a question. We mentioned the Commonwealth Games, so let's hear more about that. I understand the Commonwealth Games are being held in Birmingham in July this year, 2022, and a lot of work, I'm sure, has gone into making the Games as inclusive, accessible, and as sustainable as possible. So I'd love to hear from you. What has been done to prepare the city's public transport network to get participants and athletes to and from the Games? And what have been your priorities in that?
Well, we're 99 days from the Games, not that I'm counting. We bid for the Games for 2026. And then Durban was supposed to be hosting the Games, I think, in 2022 and pulled out. So they've accelerated the Games in our region to 2022. We are rebuilding two train stations ready for the Games at some of the venues that are going to see the biggest footfall. We're putting in a bus rapid transit scheme, a couple of cycleways, all of that in addition to upgrading the signaling on our existing network to make sure that we can actively manage it. We need to make sure that spectators can get to where they need to be, that athletes can get to where they need to be, but also that the network runs, for the fact that people will still be traveling to work and wanting to move around this city and the other locations that the Commonwealth Games are being hosted in. Regardless, this has been the biggest challenge, because not only are we trying to deliver 4 years ahead of schedule, which for major construction projects is incredibly difficult, but if you add to that the impact of Brexit, which we have felt both in terms of supply chains and labor, then throw a global pandemic on top of it and trying to construct through the pandemic, and now the increase in prices around utilities and materials, it's been unbelievable. And I just think that not only have the team here, but all of our partners across the region have done a tremendous job. I mean, we didn't know whether we would have spectators. We didn't know what the COVID rules were going to be. It's been incredibly challenging to try to plan for a Games, you know, over the past few years. So I can't wait to come and explain and share our learning with colleagues in Australia for hosting it in 2026. What I can also say is, despite all the challenges, it is such a huge privilege, and we can't wait to have our region, in the eyes of the world, and to show off all the things that we know and love about it. And it's starting to get really exciting now with just under 100 days to go. But my goodness, it has been nothing short of a Herculean effort from people across this region.
I can only imagine to have accelerated the games. You're 99 days away. How exciting. And thank you for sharing what that program has been like. I really look forward to hearing actually your learnings. So let's tee up a session after the games, you know, because I think Melbourne's hosting the Commonwealth Games, but Brisbane's actually hosting the Olympic Games in 2032. So there's probably lots of insights actually that would be really relevant to our region.
Absolutely. I'll be on the next flight.
Yeah, let's bring you out. That would be awesome. All right. I wanted to talk with you about another initiative, which I thought was really interesting, that in Birmingham last year, you launched a clean air zone. And I want to hear more about that. I think it's, you know, interesting in our region, you know, policymakers are considering things like clean air zones, congestion zones, how we might charge to really, you know, pull those levers to restrict car travel, but also to improve emissions. And I wanted to ask you, you know, if you could explain a bit more about what is your clean air zone, and also, do you have any lessons that you could share with decision makers who are looking at implementing that kind of policy?
This clean air zone was put in place by one of our councils. As I said, Birmingham is the second largest city after London in the UK. I have to say, I think it was a really bold thing to do. It's never popular, is it? But the government mandated that a number of cities that had really big challenges around clean air must do it. And it essentially charges within what I would refer to as our inner ring road vehicles that aren't compliant to come in and out of the city center. We were faced here with a bit of a sort of carrot stick challenge. So people saying, well, it's fine for cities that have, you know, world-class public transport systems like New York or London, but When you're still building your network, which we clearly are, it's not fair to, until it's done, to, you know, try to make people pay to drive. So that was a difficult one to challenge, really, but it was important that it was done and that it held. And one of the things I say quite frequently is, try to name a world-class city that doesn't in some way try to restrict cars from driving through its center, or close your eyes and think of the favorite place that you've ever been on holiday. Were you on the edge of a two-lane motorway? No, most people think of pedestrianized areas with good public spaces and places for people to gather. And people instantly identify that places like that have to restrict the traffic. So I think it's a mark of a world-class city to have put something that limits the amount of traffic in. Not everybody would agree with me, but that would be my advice for decision makers. Try to think about it the other way. We have cities where the sort of population of the inner city is more deprived than some of our leafier suburbs. You know, is it fair that people who live outside of the area and have the ability to breathe fresh, clean air then are allowed to drive into areas where that's not the case and pollute them? There's an argument that's not just either.
That is so interesting to think about, Laura. I actually probably haven't reflected in quite that way before around, you know, imagine a city that you've been to and what was so great about it. And actually all the cities I thought of, like Oslo, pedestrianized in the city center, you know, they did that a few years ago, and wow. So thank you. And it's awesome to hear that it is absolutely world-leading and that you're doing that in Birmingham. I wanted to ask you a bit more about public transport. And I understand you are also the chair of the Urban Transport Group, which comprises transport leaders from Greater Manchester, Liverpool City Region, London, South Yorkshire, Tyne and Wear, West Midlands and West Yorkshire regions. And if I've got that wrong, please correct me. But I wanted to ask you, could you share a bit about what that group is and maybe some examples of how working together through the Urban Transport Group has benefited its members and the communities that you serve?
It is my great pleasure to chair the Urban Transport Group, because what it does is it brings together the people that do my job up and down this country together. And in fact, we have a board meeting tomorrow and a dinner this evening, which I'm greatly looking forward to. What makes it such a great group is that although our places are slightly different, our networks are slightly different, we're all trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to build world-class transport networks for the people that rely on them. And whether you're in Newcastle or in London, your goals are the same. We face a lot of the same challenges as working with the Department for Transport nationally, drawing down funding, addressing issues around devolution and control of networks, pricing, back office ticketing. So there are a huge amount of challenges that we all work on together. And we have a strong, powerful lobby as an urban transport group. We do a lot of direct lobbying of government on what matters to our members and to our people, and have quite a lot of influence that way. But for me also, it's just such a pleasure because these are colleagues that I've worked with for years, but I also consider them to be my friends. And when I'm faced with a challenge that I can't see my way through, I know that I can pick the phone up and call any number of people and they'll have faced the same challenge and they might have an idea or a different way to do it. And we're not in competition with each other. We're genuinely collaborative. So it is both a place where that's a trusted space where we can share some of the challenges that we're facing and learn from each other. It's a place where collectively we know our voice is stronger because we represent so many cities and people up and down the country. And then also a like-minded group of professionals. And sometimes when you're in jobs like this, you really need that. They're both, you need to have people that are both your friends and your colleagues. So for me, it is part of my job, but it is actually gives me a huge amount of professional and personal pleasure to do it.
That's so great to hear. And I think it's so important having a network. I mean, that's really important to our association and our members. So I can really appreciate how beneficial it would be to be sharing that knowledge and information. Laura, I wanted to change course now, and I'd love to hear more about your professional journey, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. I understand you did a bachelor's degree in political science and economics, and then a master's in urban planning. And I was interested in that. I wanted to ask, what inspired you to focus on urban planning as a postgraduate student?
This is a true story. I was graduated from university and I lived in California for a while. Then I moved back to New York City and I came home one night. I was working in a bank because I didn't really know what else to do. And I had done some banking when I lived in San Francisco. And I'm sure I had poured myself a large glass of wine and somebody had put through the post box a catalog for New York University. And I remember just flipping through it. I don't know why I was flipping through it, just having a look through it. And I saw something that said, the New York City waterfront, how does it work? And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I was sort of looking at that. And then something else about the waste off the island of Manhattan, which is only 18 miles long, all the building materials and building waste and that comes on and off the island. And how do we move this many millions of people every day on and off this tiny island? Actually, how does this island work? How did we dig tunnels to put metro? And I was sort of thinking, what is this? This is fascinating to me. This is all about this place that I live and actually all the things that make this city what it is. And I was sort of looking then through and it said something about urban planning. And honestly, I didn't even know what it was. I was like, I didn't know you could do that. What is that? So I sort of put it down and came back to it the next day. And I thought, you know, I would be really interested in almost every single one of these classes that's being taught. So I applied to go to night school and I got in. So I continued to work through the day. And then for 3 years, instead of two, I went to NYU at night and got a master's degree in urban planning. And I absolutely loved every minute of it. And I just didn't know it was a thing. So it was a complete and total fluke, probably, you know, enhanced by a large glass of red wine.
That is an awesome story. It's amazing, isn't it, though, you know, how people kind of fall into areas that they work in. And people always kind of say that about transport, that something inspires you or you fall into it. You don't necessarily leave school thinking that that's what you're going to work in.
I didn't even know it was a thing. I didn't know it was never in any of my career prospects or in any career advice I was ever given. So I didn't know it was there. And then, you know, as I worked in sort of regeneration for a while, and then, you know, broader sort of planning and, you know, doing planning applications for big sites. And then I started working more and more in transport. And then it just sort of naturally sort of funneled into transport. But of course, transport is a critical part of what makes a place work, but it's enabler of that. So if you have, I always say, if you have a network that takes people from someplace they didn't want to start their journey to someplace they don't want to end their journey, then you have no decent infrastructure. So just building infrastructure for its own sake isn't good urban planning. And that's the bit that I'm really quite passionate about.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I can really hear how passionate you are, Laura. So thank you for sharing a bit of your personal story in that. I wanted to ask, as a professional, you know, what motivates you and how are your values connected to your work? And as an extension of that, has that changed over the course of your career?
They're absolutely integral to it. So I always use the phrase, what's the lowest common denominator? So as I mentioned, for a number of years, I worked at an investment bank. And sort of the lowest common denominator in that space was that everybody who worked there wanted to make some money. And that's fine, but that didn't particularly inspire me. When I moved into public service, which is what I do now, and in America, I went to school, they call it the School for Public Service. You find that if you make that equivalent comparison, so what is the thing that brings everybody to work here? What's the lowest common denominator? In the West Midlands Combined Authority, it is to make this a better place to live and work. That is what gets people up, whether they work in housing or skills or the net zero team or transport. They work here because they're passionate about this place. And no doubt, most people who work here could leave tomorrow, go to the private sector and earn more money. But that's not what drives them. And so as a professional, I've always been motivated by making some place better and leaving something in a better place than you found it. And the only thing I would say that's changed over the course of my career is I'm more passionate. I say the words social justice a lot more now than I used to, but I do say quite often, public transport is social justice. You know, if you want to condemn a place to poverty, take away people's ability to get to education and work, and you will do it. So I really feel like, looking back over the time we had here during the pandemic, the people who relied on public transport were, again, the people who didn't have access to any other way to travel, but they were also our key workers. They were the people who were nurses and bus drivers, and keeping the people who had to be getting from place to place because we needed them to working. And I think if anything, that's just reiterated to me how absolutely critical it is to provide a clean, affordable, safe network to people. I think that's just distilled even more to me over the past few years.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And I've got to say, Laura, your passion and values come out so clearly. And I really appreciate how much of your authentic self, you know, really shines as you're talking through these things, because the pandemic absolutely has brought this home. And I know we've spoken about it, but in some ways I feel like it often though gets missed a bit too, you know, because there's so much going on, there's so much uncertainty, and we're all in a state of flux, let alone our transport system. So in this vein of looking back over your career, you know, we've looked back over the last couple of years around the pandemic, but, you know, looking back, is there a professional achievement that you would say you're most proud of?
If we get through the games in one piece, I suspect eventually I might cite that, but as we're not quite there yet, I think it's definitely how we kept our network running for those people who depended on it through the pandemic. You know, everything from having to rapidly learn how to distribute masks and clean vehicles and run services and keep our staff motivated and keep our staff safe and take the network down to bare bones, which was much easier than trying to build it back up. You know, that to me has been, I think, the most thing I'm most proud of. As I said, if we come through the games unscathed, that will probably hit the list. But also, I think one of the biggest challenges we'll have is to get people to return to public transport. In many countries, the only place you still have to wear a mask is on public transport. And that is leaving people with a very real legacy of thinking that public transport is less safe than everywhere else. And we will be a long time recovering from that position and encouraging people to get back to using public transport. I think around the world, we've seen a car-based recovery. That'll be the next challenge. If as an organization, we can play a meaningful role in that as well, that's something I'd be really proud of if we can do it.
I hope you can. I hope we all can. I think we're all trying to avoid a car-led recovery, and that's what we're seeing, isn't it? But yeah, hopefully, you know, in the coming years, the perception around the safety of public transport will change, because we know that that is affecting people's ability or interest in catching public transport at the moment. Laura, you've spoken about so much, actually, activity that you've got on your plate, the planning for the games, the recovery from COVID. And I wanted to ask you, you've obviously got a lot going on. How do you find time for yourself? I read that you're a keen runner and a cyclist and a cricket fan. And, you know, it's something that often when I'm speaking to women on this podcast or peers, and I think the work-life balance thing is always something that women struggle with. And I wanted to ask you, as a senior exec, how do you find balance? How do you find that time for self-care?
You have to be ruthless. I mean, you really have to ferociously block it out. You know, I, like everybody else, have gone a little bit soft and squidgy over the past couple of COVID years, for sure. And I need to get back to doing much more that helps keep my mind clear. I think that's the key to me. If I'm going to bring my best self to work, for me, I need to have burnt off some energy, whether that's running or cycling or even walking as I'm getting older, to clear my mind. I find the weeks that I don't carve that time out for myself, as the week goes on, I'm less good at my job. I struggle to see as clearly. I struggle to be as present at work. I struggle to have the energy that I need to do the job. And I think when you don't carve that time out for yourself, you're not as good at your job as you could be. So for whatever people need for themselves, whether it's, you know, to lie in the bathtub and read a book or whatever you do to recharge yourself, you have to cut that time out. And you have to cut it out to be with your family as well. My husband's always joking, you know, if I start to work really long days and long hours, he says, are you not very good at your job then? I said, what? He said, well, if you can't do your job in a reasonable amount of time, either the job is wrong or you're not doing a very good job of it. And it always makes me laugh, but it is sort of right. It can't be your life. You can have as much pride and passion in your job as I like to think that I do, but I don't mistake it for my life. And my life is my life with my family and my friends. And I just think you have to find that balance if you're going to be really good at your job, and you have to block it out and take the time out of the diary. And you can build that into the corporate culture, which is what I like to think that we've done here. So we have a flexible workplace. Some people pick their kids up from work and then log on after 9. It's the way that we're all working is changing. And we've been learning about that through the pandemic. But presenteeism, being in at 7 a.m. and staying till 10 p.m. isn't something I think that will be recognized going forward. But you can be really good at your job and take care of what you need for yourself and your family. And I just would encourage anybody not to sacrifice one for the other.
That's such great advice, Laura. I mean, you do have to be ferocious. You actually got me thinking about an old boss of mine used to say to me, you should be able to do your job in 4 hours a day. Like, that's your aim. You know, how can you be more efficient? How can you empower the team? So I appreciate your advice. And also your husband's questions, I think, are great too. They really got me thinking.
Don't tell him that.
That's okay. He's probably not in our target audience. Although we do.
Definitely not.
I know, but actually it turns out that 35% of our listeners are now male, which I was astounded by, actually. So it's been really interesting to see that. We are nearly at the end of the interview and I've got two questions left, and they're the two questions that I always finish on, that we always get really good feedback about when our listeners are tuning in. So the first question is, how do you plan your career? So do you have like a 5 or 10 year plan, or do you prefer to take the opportunities as they come?
I'm going to give you a funny answer to this, which is both. So I do have a 5-year plan and I have a 10-year plan, but much like the birthing plan that I devised before I had my son. I am prepared to set it on fire because that's about how likely it is to pan out the exact way that you think it is. It's so ridiculous, right? I mean, you can make all the plans you want, but life doesn't go that way, does it? So I think it's important to have a measure of success. So if you sit down on day one in a job and you think, well, 5 years is a good long time to be in a job, what would I want to have achieved in 5 years? And write it down. Write it down on a whiteboard and constantly check in and make sure that that is what you're doing. So if what you want to do is, I don't know, ensure that you have integrated, you know, ticketing across your network, that you want to have the cleanest service, I don't know, write them down. Write those five things down that you think you want to do and use that as a guide just to make sure that you are focusing your time and energy on that big stuff that you thought was important, but then also recognize that, you know, life doesn't work out in the way that we always want it to. And plans are very well made, but very well forgotten. And just because you've got a plan maybe to stay someplace for 10 years, that's no good reason to not consider other opportunities that come your way and continue to challenge yourself. So I think it's important to do both, have a plan and then be prepared to destroy it.
That is so great, Laura. I think everyone is going to take something away from that. Thank you. My last question, the one I always finish on, can you please share your top piece of advice for younger female transport professionals?
Yes. Remember what you're doing, why you're doing it, and why you're passionate about it. Transport is such an amazing career to have. And there's so many elements of it that are attractive to people working in it. So there's everything from planning to building to operating. And there's no bit of that job that you can't have if you want it. When I started, one of the things I found was that people used to want to talk to me about chassis and vehicle types, and especially in railway, you know, all the things that I just wasn't even slightly interested in. I was interested in, does this service take people from where they want to go to where they need to be? Is it a service that people would feel safe traveling on? Can people afford it? Is it the right thing for the public? Is it the right thing for this place? And I think my advice, especially to women, is don't be intimidated if you wind up in a situation where people are talking about an element of transport that you neither are interested in or care about. Remember why you wanted to get into transport. Be passionate about the reasons that you are interested in it. And don't let anybody intimidate you or make you feel that you don't have a role to play if you don't know what the, you know, 380 chassis in the 1960s did for the steam engine. It just doesn't matter. That's not necessarily the whole reason that people work in transport. For me, as I said, it's about social justice. It's about equality of opportunity. And those are the things that get me up in the morning. And when we're talking about women's influence, one of the things that I always say is, you know, we have to think about equality of design. You know, when people say, well, how do you know that women aren't involved in designing transport? And I said, well, try to get a double buggy on a bus. You'll realize the last time that, you know, somebody thought about that who is designing actual infrastructure or the buses themselves. It's nigh on impossible. So there's a role for you to play. And I think just trying to remember never to be intimidated out of what you want to do and why it's important to you.
That is awesome advice, Laura. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm sure all of our listeners took something away from that. This is the end of all my questions. I was just going to ask, is there anything that you would like to share that you didn't cover off, or if you've got any final words for our audience?
Oh, just that I think it is an amazing career to have. And when you think about it, not in terms of an end to itself, but sort of what it does for people, it's just such a privilege. And if you wind up like me behind a desk all the time, just don't forget to get out and talk to people. Go to the bus station, talk to the bus station managers, talk to the people getting on the bus. Remind yourself of what you do and why you do it, because it makes a huge difference to people in their life every single day. And reminding yourself of that is a great way to remind yourself of why you're proud of who you are and what you do. And that's the best feeling you can have at work.
Absolutely. I agree. I love working in public transport. It's life. It's so good. Laura, thank you so much. That's all we have time for. But I just want to say it has been glorious speaking with you and hearing about the exciting things you're doing in Birmingham and the games. But also, thank you so much for being so transparent and open about your career journey and some of your lessons as well. And I just want to say, let's get you over here, down under. Really keen to hear about your experience with the games and best of luck.
I can't wait. Look forward to doing it face-to-face.
Awesome. Thanks so much. You've been listening to Laura Schoaf, the Chief Executive of the West Midlands Combined Authority in England. I'm your host, Michelle Batsis, and please join me again soon to hear from more inspiring women who move nations. Thank you for listening to Women Who Move Nations, the public transport podcast. This series is produced by Dylan Adler with copywriting by Sophia Dickinson. Thanks for joining us as we profile women working in public transport and sustainable mobility and inspire the next generation of female leaders. I'm Michelle Batsis. Keep safe and keep our nations moving.